Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, and we're going to take a look at the latest edition of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, for you and for me. Focuses on healthy eating patterns, and my guest today is Beth Olson, who is going to help us understand the new guidelines, explain what it means for what you and I eat. She is an associate professor in nutritional sciences at UW-Madison, also with of UW Extension. She's a specialist in family living programs there. And Beth, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me come.
I'd love to have you here. You know, before we get into the guidelines, what impact do they really have on what we eat? I mean, do they impact what Americans eat?
They do. They serve as the cornerstone for the U.S. government in setting up their food programs that they use, for instance, the school lunch and school breakfast program and adult feeding programs. It's used to set policies. It's used with other programs that serve low-income populations, such as WIC. We use them in UW Extension to inform our own nutrition education programs. And then they're often picked up and used by others, like businesses, stores, places like that, to promote their products.
So a big impact.
Yes.
And, you know, and they change from time to time, and things happen, and I think it's been, what, since 1980, they release new guidelines every 5 years. And we'll talk about what's new or, let's do that. What's new or different in the most recent edition of the dietary guidelines?
So there were a few things that were different that really were picked up, and some people may have already seen them in the press. One was they decided not to continue with the very specific guideline for 300 milligrams per day limit on cholesterol. It was decided that our evidence has been accumulating for a number of years that there are many things involved with what happens with our blood cholesterol besides just dietary cholesterol. Our whole diet really has an impact, and there are a lot of other factors involved in heart disease. So they decided that continuing to say 300 milligrams per day just wasn't needed.
Sugar was, I think, highlighted or low-lighted, however you want to look at it, in the guide.
Yes, indeed it was. For the first time, they put a number on their recommendation to limit added sugars, and that number is 10% of our total calories. That's actually in a line with some recommendations that come from other organizations, such as the World Health Organization.
And you think about it, well, that shouldn't be that hard, but I mean, even ketchup, I made ketchup one time, and I think the recipe called for like a cup of sugar in a bottle of ketchup.
Yes, there is added sugar in a lot of our foods. However, when we look at what the major sources of added sugars are, major sources really the sugar-sweetened beverages, things like soda pops, fruit drinks, energy drinks, different kinds of coffee drinks. Also, another big source is what we call grains and grain desserts, things like cookies, donuts, pies, cakes. So there's sugar added to a lot of foods, but those two groups are the two of the major sources of added sugars in their diets.
Beth Olson, our guest today from the University of Wisconsin and UW Extension, as we talk with her about dietary guidelines. The new ones are out, been out for a little bit now, and I want to get those straight. You may have questions about them, or you may have general nutrition questions. Join in. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or if you'd like, you can post on our Facebook page. And our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show. And so that's where to go if you're going to go to our Facebook page. And let's talk about patterns. There was, rather than being so specific about individual foods, it looks to me like they're talking about sort of more general patterns, life patterns in terms of your eating?
Yes, the U.S. Dietary Guidelines has been talking in the last couple of editions of their guidelines about healthy dietary patterns, but they really emphasized it in this latest edition. And it was an acknowledgement that we don't know everything about individual nutrients or even individual foods, but we have some good evidence that healthy patterns, so combining those foods together, lead to good health outcomes. And so rather than focusing on a particular nutrient or a particular food, they put together healthy patterns that are associated with good long-term outcomes for our health.
And there was some comment about men and boys, as I recall. I took a look at that and thought, well, that's probably right, that we eat too much protein.
Yes. Well, protein intake tends to go up when we eat more calories. So men and boys eat more calories. But indeed, they tend to be the people that consume more protein than they actually need. And then there are dietary patterns that would allow them to continue to eat the protein they like in bit smaller amounts, and perhaps replace some of those foods with other foods that they don't eat as much of, like fruits and vegetables.
All right. There we go. Brian in Fox Valley has a comment, so let's go there. Brian, hi. Thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a heart patient. I also have diabetes, and all this was fairly recently. And I guess I would like to talk about what's referred to as the lipid hypothesis from some odd 40 years ago, where they said that, you know, fats were bad and we should avoid them like the plague. And if you're not eating fats, I guess you're going to eat a bunch of sugars, which, frankly, I think was my problem. So about a half year ago or so, I switched over to what's called a high-fat, low-carb diet, where I eat an awful lot of fat, and I have almost completely eliminated almost all carbs. No grains, no potatoes, no sugars, and that includes even oatmeal. And I guess I would just like to hear your comments on that.
Comments on that, okay.
Yeah, so the U.S. dietary guidelines are really intended for healthy Americans over the age of 2 and not people with chronic conditions, although a good portion of the U.S. population is now overweight, which is a chronic condition. But in their guidelines, they don't recommend that we remove food groups such as grains. And they still do talk about being careful about how much dietary fat we consume. The caller points out a good thing for all of us to think about, which is sometimes we put out a dietary message and people see it in isolation, and that's why they really wanted to emphasize food groups. So I think years ago when we began to talk to people about being careful about how much fat was in their diet, what we probably didn't say well was try to be careful about the fat in your diet, doing some substitutions, and increase some things in your diet like whole grains and fruits and vegetables. And indeed, some people perhaps brought down the fat in their diet, but they did that by using maybe non-fat salad dressing instead of high-fat salad dressing, instead of using less salad dressing and more vegetables on their salad, which is, I think, what we meant, but we probably didn't do a good enough job communicating to the public.
Yeah, and so that low-cal salad dressing is okay?
Oh, I think it's perfectly good. It's just that we don't mean because now you're not using high-fat salad dressing. Use a lot of that low-fat salad dressing. What we mean is be careful about the fat in your diet, but also increase foods that, in effect, could help displace some of that fat, like fruits and vegetables, whole grains.
And there are situations where, and Brian was talking about his own situation, but there are situations where one could go with proper guidance, go off the nutrition guidelines, or have to because of health considerations.
Oh, definitely. As I said, the guidelines are written as general guidelines for the population 2 and above. Well, we know that's a very diverse group. And so the dietary patterns actually do accommodate a lot of personal preferences, cultural traditions, likes and dislikes, but they're not meant to be medical, what we would call medical nutrition therapy. They aren't meant to help people who have very specific, say, allergies, intolerances, diseases that need help from a healthcare provider, a registered dietitian,
sure,
or someone like that.
Sure. Brian, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, with your question or comment. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. We'd love to hear from you. I was thinking about a friend of mine who's talking about his dad, and his dad has high cholesterol, and so he got on some cholesterol-lowering drugs, and he said, oh, good, now I can continue to eat the same things because my cholesterol will be low anyway.
Yeah, we try to work with people in terms of taking a first approach, which might include, you know, diet and activity and things like that. But even with that, there's some people that really do need and benefit from medication, and we respect that.
Beth Olson, our guest. Again, join in at 800-642-1234. There is a call in there, too, for the role of nutrition and physical activity.
Yes. So the dietary guidelines, if one wanted to see the dietary guidelines first, you can go to health.gov. But there is also a tab on that website for the dietary or the physical activity recommendations for Americans. And the dietary guidelines note that when we're working on things like our prevention of chronic disease, there's a role for physical activity as well as nutrition. And so they do point people towards those guidelines.
And I'm thinking about some sort of individual things. I often will get some V8, for example. I get the low sodium V8 juice, tomato juice. It's like I like the taste of it, and it is lower sodium than the original. And it says on the can that that's two servings of a vegetable.
Yes, and it may be two servings of a vegetable, and indeed, fruit juices, tomato juices, blends that are 100% juice are an important source of fruits and vegetables for some people. We want to encourage people not to use juices as their only source of fruits and vegetables. They can be lower in dietary fiber, for instance.
Yeah.
Sometimes they can have added sugars or they can have added sodium. So we also encourage them to eat whole fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, I think a can's like 70 calories or something like that.
So yes, that's reasonable.
For lunch, it works great when you're doing a kind of a quick lunch. Well, we have some callers online. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. I'm Larry Mehler. Breanne Chasseau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're visiting with Beth Olson. Beth is Associate Professor in Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison and UW Extension. Always great to be able to talk with her about what's going on in the nutrition field and looking at the new dietary guidelines with her today. So call in 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@WPR.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. And let's turn to Glenn in Madison next. Glenn, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest if she or any in the, it seems like anybody, all the people in the diet industry seem to have built this whole idea about managing fat, managing heart disease, diabetes, et cetera, on a false premise. And I wonder if she knows anything about Gary Taub. He's done a lot of research exposing even groups like WHO, the World Health Organization, National Institutes of Health, all those kinds of organizations, how they built this premise, and they discarded all kinds of information that would be pertinent to the facts of the diet business and how to control fat, diabetes, heart disease, et cetera. And I wonder why they continue to promote this whole idea. The premise that they're built on is a false premise as far as I'm concerned. I read the book by Gary Taub, Good Calories, Bad Calories. He's also done a lot of research on salt, and it's all adverse to the whole premise that the diet industry is built on. Could you respond?
Comment on that?
Well, I'm not sure I can speak for the entire diet industry. I'll just start with myself as a nutritionist. And as a nutritionist, I've tried to put things in context for a long time. So as I think an earlier caller noted on fat, it is just one part of our diet. And I think we did not communicate well that when we were talking about it, we needed to talk about it better in the context of the whole diet. And so it isn't all about fat. It's not all about salt. It's about the diet as a whole, which is why the guidelines have gone with patterns. And I think within that, we have to always acknowledge that individuals are different. And so there are some individuals who have responded better to some types of diets than others. And that's, if that's true, then that's what they need to do. And so we encourage people, although these are our general nutrition education for everybody guidelines, that for their specific needs, they still need to talk to their health care provider, a dietitian, to see what needs to be perhaps modified to best suit their own individual genetic makeup, biochemistry, etc.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Glenn, for calling. I want to give Christina and Madison a chance to join us as well. Hi, Christina. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I just had a question about, you know, at least from what I understand, when your body goes into quote-unquote starvation mode, if you haven't, you know, eaten in, it could be as short as, you know, 4 to 10 hours, that you're typically burning your carbohydrates, your sugars first, and, you know, liver and muscle kind of metabolize things differently, but then you go into burning proteins, and then finally you start to burn fat. So I was just curious as to if there is a difference in that kind of order when you're exercising, how you can get to an exercise level where you're achieving this kind of fat-burning workout.
Yeah, I think the I'm not an exercise physiologist, but I think that some of what we want to do when we're exercising is, one thing is we simply have to burn off a certain number of calories if what we're trying to do is lose weight. Then there's a fair bit of science around what kind of sports you do and what's the best way to eat to improve your training and your performance. And again, I couldn't give individual recommendations on that. But I think for one thing people need to realize, and what we call it in nutritional biochemistry, is something called mixed fuel burning. You're always burning some of various fuels, but how much of different ones vary? And what we tend to do is burn a bit more fat when we slow up a bit. So in other words, if you try to just always do very high intensity sprinting kind of exercise, that has to have carbohydrate or blood glucose. It's when you do a longer, a bit more moderately paced workout, so you go an hour or a little more, and you keep your level a bit lower so you can keep going, that you begin to burn your fat stores.
I was talking to one of the exercise physiologists who says, if you're out there, it's good to maybe run fast a bit, but then slow down and kind of...
Yeah, and I think that varies
back and forth with
what you're trying to achieve with your training. If you're trying to achieve being a sprinter, or you just want to burn calories, or you're trying to achieve endurance. But certainly I think, like our food, if you do a variety of activities, it also keeps it more engaging for you.
Well, yeah, for sure. Christina, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. Marion Viola emailed, and she said she's an elementary teacher at a school where half the student body eats school breakfast. Based on current guidelines, French toast sticks with syrup meet nutritional guidelines. The school's open to more nutritious items for the breakfast menus, but one of the problems is the wholesale suppliers of food to the schools. And Mary wants to know if you think these new guidelines will require institutional food suppliers to improve their offerings.
Well, the dietary guidelines are set, are to be used for our nutrition programs in our schools. I don't know the current exact state of legislation, but there were many changes based on the last dietary guidelines made to the school meal patterns, but they were given some time to implement those, and I don't think all of them have yet been implemented. I think if people are very concerned, it's something they might want to contact their legislators about to find out where that is and what their legislatures would like to see in the speed of having some of those guidelines put into practice in our school meal programs.
As I look at some of the school meal programs, they're talking to some parents who say my kids got 20 minutes to eat, and by the time they get in line, get through the line, they've got 10 minutes to eat or 5 minutes to eat. And I often wonder about how eating your lunch in 5 minutes.
Yes, indeed. I think that's an excellent point. There's been research to look at whether having children eat so quickly is beneficial. It's not. But also the timing of recesses that occur around the lunchtime, and some fairly good work to say that kids ought to go out and have a good recess and then come in and have time enough to eat. That many kids are rushing through their lunch because after lunch they get to go outside, and that's what they're anxious to do.
Let's turn to Bob in Platteville next. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Yeah, my wife has celiac disease, which requires a gluten-free diet, and I'm having a difficult time finding gluten-free food in stores, and I wonder if there's any resources that might help me locate gluten-free food.
Yeah, a little better than it was 5 years ago, for sure.
I think you have to read labels carefully. There was recently some improvements made to the guidelines for producing gluten-free foods, too. So in order to say gluten-free, they have to meet certain standards, which I think's helped. I don't offhand know a resource, but I think there is a celiac association that he could probably look to. And he could look to whole foods as well. So quinoa, oats, barley, there are other grains that he could purchase or they could purchase and use, and then recipes to use to cook with those that would help him substitute for the more traditional wheat that we often have in our breads and our pastas. Rice would be another source. And then I think it takes some practice in cooking to figure out where you can put in some of those things and what the modifications have to be in order to make a nice tasting food or a food you're more used to with those
and
products.
There are a couple of, I know of a couple of cookbooks right now that are for, that are out there for people with that disease. And sometimes, you know, getting your hands on the cookbook itself, well, within that, you're going to find the ingredients. And I think the celiacs, I think you're right about I'm forgetting the name of the association. But if you put celiacs association, it'll probably pop up on Google, and you can go to it. And I'm sure there are.
Yeah, I think they probably have the best resources.
Very good resources.
You might also check the American Dietetic Association. They have different groups that they have that support individual conditions, and often would have resources targeted to celiac and other conditions where people need to eliminate a particular ingredient because it's causing a problem.
And Bob's problem, of course, is, well, where do I find this stuff? You know, a lot of this. But first you need to know exactly
what it is you're looking for.
And he probably knows quite a bit of that. Probably needs a little more. Bob, I hope that helps.
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. And Richard in Janesville, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. I would like to hear what comments you think about coconut oil in the food diet.
Yeah.
So coconut oil, we would generally consider more of a saturated fat. The tropical oils tend to be more solid at room temperature, so they tend to act more like saturated fats, which the dietary guidelines do recommend we try to keep lower in our diet. However, if we keep our total fat low enough and watch our saturated fat intake, there's a variety of fats that one could use, and there may be some reason that a person wants to use some coconut oil in a particular recipe. It wouldn't necessarily be one I'd be looking for on a packaged food to try to include in my diet, but there may be a specific reason that it's helpful in some sort of dish or cooking. And as long as one keeps one's total fat and saturated fat at a reasonable level, then moving among a variety of fats is probably a good idea.
Yeah, probably wouldn't hurt at all. Did you have another question, Richard?
Yeah, well, the point on the coconut oil is actually coconut has 50% lauric acid, which I call the Christmas tree acid. Because, in other words, what about ketones? In other words, burning that instead of glucose?
Yeah, generally we don't burn ketones instead of glucose unless we don't consume much carbohydrate. Most of us consume a fair amount of carbohydrate. We tend to consume ketones when we aren't eating enough, when we're starving, and we begin to mobilize fat, and we have too much of it, so they make it into ketone bodies, which our brain can use. This happens when people have diabetes and aren't aware that they have diabetes because they don't have the ability to use their blood glucose, and so they produce ketones. But in general, it's not something that's normal for most of us in eating a healthy diet to have a lot of ketones in our system.
Oh, there we go. Richard, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or comments. You can email us at talk@WPR.org. In fact, Steve did that in Madison. He says, news coverage on the guidelines said adolescent males and men should reduce their protein intake. We did talk a little bit about that. But he said the article that he read gave no base optimal intake for protein, nor any explanation for this current recommendation. So maybe you could talk a little more about that.
Yes. If one wanted to see the details, you can, again, go to health.gov and click on the Dietary Guidelines tab, and their rationale is in there about protein. I think often what people don't realize is that for the nutrients that provide us energy, carbohydrate, protein, and fat, there is a recommendation for a range. So a range of protein, a range of carbohydrate, a range of fat that we can then move within in order to construct the diet that is both healthy but suits our own personal preferences. So protein actually has a fairly broad range of between 10% and 35% of our total calories. That's a pretty good range.
Yeah.
And so the dietary guidelines looked at usual patterns of protein intakes in different age and gender groups, and boys, a bit older boys and men, were above that 35% range. So the range that's considered most optimal for health, those people are above, and that's why they recommended that they consider bringing down their protein. And one has to always think of this in combination. So if they're eating that much protein, what aren't they eating?
Yeah.
And their intakes for many people, but older children and boys and men, is really low in some things like fruits and vegetables and whole grains, really low. And so I think they're not
vegetables
just saying bring that down.
Yeah.
Add some of the other. So in that mixed dish, pull the meat back a little bit and increase the vegetables in it a little bit, and you'll achieve both things at one time.
Yeah, absolutely. We have Deborah in Waupaca next. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. My husband Robert and I read Michael Pollan's book, Cooked, and he was talking about the importance of probiotics. And so would you talk about that a little bit and say what foods we should eat? Thank you.
Yep, thanks for calling. What are probiotics? Are they good?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of research in recent years looking at what happens in our GI tract, particularly what kind of microorganisms are on there, and realizing that the composition of those microorganisms has an effect on our health. And so we don't know yet exactly what it should be. We don't know yet exactly what people should eat, but there is some suggestions of foods like yogurt. A lot of people have heard about that. But also, I think any foods that contain a variety of dietary fiber will promote bacteria that are healthy for our GI tract. So fruits, vegetables, whole grains, which have dietary fiber, will promote, I think, a healthy gastrointestinal tract. There are a lot of probiotic supplements. Because we don't know exactly what promotes outside of the foods those bacteria, it's hard to say whether any of those are going to prove helpful.
Okay.
At this point.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Deborah. Appreciate your call. What about coffee? I see coffee now. We can have a couple cups of coffee a day without injury.
Yes, I think
injury.
The way the Dietary Guidelines Committee phrased this was, at the amounts of caffeine that we currently consume, we're doing okay. There's no evidence that it's harming us. They're not encouraging people to consume more caffeine. There are groups for whom they have some caution. So there's a limit that is set for pregnant women, for instance. We want to be careful about children consuming energy drinks who aren't used to that much caffeine. But for most of us, a few cups of coffee a day seems to be not of any concern.
Yeah. Was there anything in the guidelines that surprised you when you read it and looked at it?
That's a good question. I hadn't really thought about it that way. I think I was I was surprised in a way about how little some of it had changed.
Yeah.
Not surprised because I think the evidence is different, but I think that there was some really good acknowledgement in the dietary guidelines that some of the messages that we've been putting out for years is holding up. And so I was glad to see that they were more firm about that. For instance, on the dietary guidelines, that if we look at these food groups and we put them together in a variety of ways, we can really have healthy diets. And over time, we haven't found that those patterns have caused any ill effects. They seem to be associated with good effects, and we haven't seen anything bad. So they seem to be quite enduring. So I was a bit surprised they put so much emphasis on that, but I was also pleased.
Yeah. Okay. So coffee's okay. Marina and Trempolo couldn't stay with us. However, she wondered if people can eat barley if they have celiac disease.
Well, I think
she thought it had gluten.
I don't think it does. I'll have to check and make sure I didn't mistake that. But one of the things one has to look at when you're is the labeling on foods that contain it. So I think we're getting better and better about that. But there used to be more contamination of our grains out in the fields, adjacent fields with different grains in the equipment that was processing the same grains, you know, processing one field and the other field. And so even grains that were, sometimes people will pick up a food that's made with a grain that doesn't have gluten and it'll say contains gluten. The manufacturer's doing that just to warn people that it could have traces because of the way it's processed. But as you mentioned, there are more and more foods that are being made where there's more care to where the source of those grains come from so that people don't have that contamination.
So if you're having let's say I'm a 40-year-old male or a 40-year-old female, I guess, what should my breakfast, lunch, and dinner look like?
Okay.
In general.
In general. So it's a good idea to try, first of all, there's been some controversy about whether we need to have breakfast. I think it's a good pattern to get into. People who have healthy diets overall tend to have be breakfast eaters. But the other thing we like to look at is, can you distribute your foods more through the day? So we tend to eat a lot of protein at dinner. Sometimes with a big piece of meat or other types of legumes or other grains, and not so much at breakfast. So maybe looking at looking at those food groups, fruits and vegetables, whole grains.
Yeah.
I know I sound like a broken record. Dairy or soy, fortified soy products, proteins, about putting a bit of those in each meal. And then the guidelines in looking at dietary patterns found out that most people have at least one snack a day, and perhaps looking at those snacks as opportunities to put in foods that you're maybe not getting as much of, like a fruit or a vegetable or something like that. But I would say distribute the food groups across your meals as a way of helping to consume something. So if you only have vegetables at dinner, it's hard to get enough of them. So can you put some at lunch? If you only have fruit once a day as a snack, then it's hard to get enough. Can you put it in your breakfast?
Yeah, those are good points for sure. Donna in Hartford had a question, so let's go there. Hi, Donna.
Yes, good morning, Larry and guests. Just tuned in a few minutes ago, but heard a caller ask about probiotics, and our family has taken them for quite a number of years, long before there was commercials out for them, which I'm glad to see. A lot of pharmacists know about this and actually suggest it especially if you have to take a lot of antibiotics, because antibiotics kill the bad bugs and they kill the good bacteria as well. And a lot of people end up with what they call C. diff. It's a long name, but shortened out as C. diff. It's very a horrible situation that people can get into, not only during the time they have antibiotics, but months after the body can react. And so there's a lot of wonderful things with the Acidophilus and the Bifidum and the Bulgarisus. And, it's just a really great thing to keep that, because most all disease is rooted in the colon. I studied this. I did this paper on it a number of years back. And so the healthier you can keep your gut,
the healthier your body will be.
Yeah.
And it just is great, like I said, especially with antibiotics. But the warning is you need to take it on two hours away, either side. That's the minimum. So 3 hours is even better. So know the rules when you get into doing natural things. But it's a great, great product, all kinds of them out there. But if you can get one with DDS-1, that's a really important product
to have in there. All right. Comment, Beth?
Well, a couple comments. One, I'm just going to back up one because I was the caller was correct that barley has gluten in it, as does rye, and then wheat. We tend not to eat as much of the other two, but we tend to eat more wheat. So choose grains other than those. But yeah, it's interesting over the years. My initial work as a graduate student in nutrition did involve the gastrointestinal tract and dietary fiber. So it's always been a love of mine. But, you know, for a lot of years, we didn't really want to talk about it. You know, nobody really wants to talk about how their gastrointestinal tract functions. It wasn't considered very polite and, you know. So it's
the opposite now.
Yeah. Now, so I'm glad people are realizing that it is an organ with a health, just like any of our other organs, and what we put into it affects its health. So we often think of nutrition for our skin or our bones or our muscles for running or something like that. But thinking about it as something that also nourishes our intestinal tract is a good thing in my opinion.
And here we are out of time, Donna, thanks again for calling. I appreciate your call. And Beth, there's other nutritional things that we can talk about over time, so I hope you'll come back and be with us again. We'll take up some other. Yeah, we'll take up some other issues, and including, of course, the dietary guidelines. Our guest, Beth Olson, Associate Professor in Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison and University of Wisconsin Extension. She's a Family Living Program Specialist in Extension. And great to have her along. We'll have her back. We'll do it again. We'll talk some more about nutrition.